chance to argue. I understand that you're going to do the standard 5 minutes for rebuttal, and you've gotten with the clerk. We have the lighting system. When the yellow light comes on, that means you have 2 minutes in whatever time period you're within. When the red light comes on, that means you're out of time and you need to look to the court to continue. The proceedings today are being audio recorded. You can get those downloaded off the website probably within 24 hours after they're put up. And by way of housekeeping, if anyone has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might go off, now's a good time to turn it off. And with that, we will hear from Mr. Kennedy.
May it please the court, there is no dispute in this case that J.D. Fields was required to collect and remit local sales taxes under Chapter 321 and 322 of the tax code. Nonetheless, J.D. Fields filed suit asking the trial court to order the comptroller to refund over $800,000 in local sales taxes and interest in direct contravention of these statutes. The trial court lacks jurisdiction to do this under the Texas Constitution and under the doctrine of sovereign immunity. Accordingly, this court should reverse the trial court's ruling and render a final judgment dismissing the suit for lack of jurisdiction. Now, I'd like to turn first to the constitutional issues and then to the sovereign immunity issues. Under the Texas Constitution, courts can neither interfere with the legislature's explicit design nor direct how the executive department enforces those laws. The separation of powers is what dictates the former. Under the separation of powers, the courts cannot order the comptroller to refund taxes without unduly interfering with the legislature's power to prescribe taxes.
What happens in just a normal situation where you don't have this representation, there's an audit done, it's determined that they didn't collect these local and MTA taxes, is the comptroller even have it within their power to say, hey, you know, don't worry about it, just start doing it from now forward?
The comptroller does have that in their power under two separate discretionary authorities. One, just under the Constitution as their authority as an executive agency, they can decide when to enforce and when not to enforce the law. The second is their settlement authority. The comptroller has been delegated settlement authority by the legislature to settle tax disputes. The same thing, the attorney general settles tax disputes when they get to court, and it's within their purview to do that. Now, in a typical case, those whether to enforce or whether or not to enforce, that's sort of that comes from the nature of being an executive agency. So executive agencies can't simply enforce every technical violation of the law. There have to be some determinations made on when to enforce, when to not to enforce. For instance, the agency has to assess when there's a violation, if there is a violation. They have to assess how strong the violation is, how far they want to pursue the case. They have to allocate resources based on their limited employees, limited funding, and things of that nature. So they have to make that sort of determination all the time.
So that discretion is not limited just to penalties and interest. It also goes to the actual tax that would have been due under a law.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, same question for detrimental reliance. Is the detrimental reliance discretion that the comptroller has, is that limited to penalties and interest, or can that also go to the actual underlying tax debt?
If the comptroller can waive penalty and interest under the statute, also they have discretion to waive taxes under their discretionary authority, as I just described, for whatever reason, whether it be under the detrimental reliance policy or under some other rationale, just by nature of their role as an executive agency of the state in deciding when to enforce, when not to enforce.
Thank you.
So back to my point about the separation of powers, the legislature prescribes taxes. The roles in tax cases are pretty clearly delineated. The legislature dictates what the law is, so they prescribe taxes. The comptroller enforces the law, including with using whatever discretion that they have, and the courts interpret the law as outlined by the legislature when called upon to do so. So here, again, the municipal and MTA taxes are what are at issue. Under the tax code, 221-203 and 322-108, those taxes are imposed based upon the location where the sale is consummated. So all of the sales in this case, all of the sales at issue, were consummated in the Houston Municipal Taxing District and the Houston MTA District.
And that's undisputed. That's on at page 6 of the record, paragraph 12, plaintiff's original petition. They concede that. They should have collected the 2% in local and MTA taxes at issue. So the court's job is to interpret the tax code and determine whether or not those taxes are owed based on the tax code. Here, there's no dispute that they're owed under the tax code. The legislature's words are binding on the court unless the legislature exceeded its constitutional authority. There's no allegation here that the comptroller exceeded its constitutional authority or that these statutes are somehow invalid. The argument here is that the comptroller should have provided relief from those taxes, which is a wholly discretionary activity.
And the comptroller has that same discretion, even though these are local and MTA taxes. There's not some strange relationship where the comptroller is a steward of having to collect those taxes.
There is a relationship where the comptroller is charged with collecting those taxes. That brings up another interesting point on the reliance, where these taxes are actually owed to MTA, the MTA district, which goes to transit in Houston, and the Houston municipal taxes. So we, in this case, we would be taking money from Houston and from the MTA and giving it back to J.D. Fields, but the comptroller is charged with collecting those taxes, so it also has the discretion to enforce or not enforce that tax code. To sort of conclude on the separation of powers argument, the trial court can't order the comptroller to refund these taxes without unduly interfering with the legislature's power to prescribe the taxes. Turning to the suspension.
What if the court's order is based upon this discretionary area that you've just told us the comptroller has? If the court's finding is not, gee, the taxes as promoted by the legislature are unfair, it's, gee, the taxes as collected and discretionary decisions by the comptroller or what the problem was. Is that still a separation of powers issue?
I believe it still is a separation of powers issue, Your Honor. Justice Rose, the issue would in that case would be the trial court would have to make a holding that the rule dictates that the taxes are not owed in direct contravention of the statute. So we would have a situation where a rule and a statute were conflicting. And in that case, under the separation of powers, the statute wins if there's a dispute between those two areas.
So are you saying the rule 3.10 conflicts with the statutes here?
We don't believe that the rule does conflict. We believe it's within the comptroller's discretion to determine whether or not the rule applies and how to apply that rule. But if J.D. Fields' interpretation is accepted, if it's a mandatory thing, if they can sue and bring a claim and the comptroller has no discretion to do anything, which is what J.D. Fields is claiming, then yes, the rule would conflict with the statute in this particular case.
Are you saying you have discretion on whether or not to apply any of these, like any of the rules promulgated by the comptroller?
The comptroller has to apply the rule. That's black letter law. That's an APA case, which is not what we're here in front of. So under the APA, the comptroller has to follow its rules. There's case law that's cited by my colleagues on the other side on that. But the issue in this case is whether the comptroller has discretion to decide whether or not there was detrimental reliance and whether or not and what relief to give. So the other issue in this case is it comes down to the plain meaning of the rule. The rule says the comptroller will give a relief. It doesn't necessarily say that the relief will be forgiveness of taxes or interest. So we've got a situation where J.D. Fields is saying this rule renders the taxes at issue unlawful. But that's not what the rule says. The rule says the comptroller will give relief. The relief could be payment over time. The relief could be it could be a waiver of certain other things. In this case, the comptroller actually did give relief. They gave a waiver of penalty in this case. So J.D. Fields is really claiming that they don't like the relief that the comptroller gave and that they can somehow attack that in court and get additional relief in the form of the taxes and interest at issue.
What if there's a, do you all dispute whatever statement they claim that the comptroller's employee at the time made? It seemed to me like there was some wiggle room or a back issue there.
There is a back issue there, and I think that's an important consideration. We do not dispute the state, well, we question whether or not the statement was made and whether there's evidence sufficient, but for the purposes of this appeal, for the purposes of jurisdiction, the testimony that was given was, the CFO of J.D. Fields asked the comptroller auditor if he could have additional time to make a sensible implementation of the changes that need to be made within J.D. Fields, and she said, I think that will be fine. Now, in terms of that, we're taking him at his word that that's what he said for the purposes of this appeal, because this is a jurisdictional issue at this point. If we get to trial on the merits, then we may very well contest that that was said or not. And the comptroller at the hearing held that there wasn't sufficient evidence to show that there was a statement that was made, because the statement that was made, the CFO did not make any contemporaneous notes. He didn't tell anybody else about it until several years later when he got the second audit that dinged him for the taxes. At that point, he told his tax consultant or attorney about the statement that was made. Now, in terms of the statement that was made, I disagree with the way it's categorized in the appellee's brief. They say it was an agreement not to collect the taxes. I disagree with that. The statement that was made, according to J.D. Fields' only witness, the only person that heard it, he has now said two times that the statement that was made was, I think that would be okay, in response to, can I have a couple of months to make a sensible implementation? So I don't even think that that reaches the issue of whether this is advice or not. She had already given advice to J.D. Fields' CFO. She said, you're collecting these taxes wrong. She sent him an email with how to collect them properly. That's the advice in this case. Then J.D. Fields' CFO asked for effectively permission to not follow the advice to bring his systems up to date and to retrain his sales force. That's not advice. That's simply permission to not follow the law.
But so we're here today on a motion for summary judgment, and you guys are focused on the jurisdictional aspect. So essentially, we haven't decided to plead a jurisdiction to get through the summary judgment, and you all, for purposes of the jurisdictional arguments, are sort of saying, okay, even if you assume that what they're claiming was said, is that where we are?
Yes, Your Honor. So we're because we brought a motion for summary judgment that included both merits arguments and jurisdictional arguments. The court initially granted that motion and then denied it after a motion for new trial. So we're here on the jurisdictional portion of that only because it's an interlocutory order at this point. So for the purposes of our jurisdictional argument, we'll assume that the statement was made. It still doesn't fall within the scope of the rule. But that's where we're at this point. Back to the suspension of laws, courts can't suspend a valid statute or dictate how the executive enforces that statute. So in other words, this gets back to sort of the point on the discretion. The comptroller and the comptroller alone has the discretion to determine how to enforce the tax code under the suspension of the law clause.
Is your discretion reviewable? Who's charged with that?
Reviewable in what sense?
Well, if you decide that, you know, we're going to grant this relief or we're not, where does someone, like if there's a situation where you grant relief to one person but not somebody else, and someone says, well, you didn't apply the rule uniformly to us, because in this other case you granted relief in that identical situation, where is that reviewable?
If it's a tax case, like the procedural posture is brought here, it's not reviewable. If the comptroller decides not to impose, if the comptroller completely abdicates its duty in some regard over a broad category, I think that may be reviewable. There may be review under the APA to say the comptroller should have applied this rule, but the point here is that it doesn't garner you a tax refund under the tax code, because the issue in the tax code is whether or not the taxes are unlawful or whether or not the comptroller may lawfully collect the taxes.
Would it have to rise to the level of an ultra-virus act of some sort to be reviewable?
That could be another way that it could be reviewable. If the comptroller is, I mean, I think there are a number of ways that it could potentially be reviewable. None in this case would apply. An ultra-virus would be one of them, a due process violation of some sort, unequal taxation of some sort, perhaps a claim that the comptroller is discriminatorily enforcing, but that requires additional elements before you can get to those sorts of issues. For instance, the discriminatory enforcement claim would require an allegation that the comptroller is doing something on the basis of race, religion, gender, or with some animus towards the taxpayer, and that's simply not the case here. So,
but I think the question is, theoretically, it is, the discretion is reviewable. For example, if the comptroller is deciding to, in its discretion, not to collect taxes from Corporation A, but from Corporation B, you would agree that there would be a due process and equal, you know, rights, equal treatment claim that could be made, and that would be
In certain instances, if the elements for those claims were met, I would agree that that is a claim that could potentially be brought. I don't think there's anything in the pleadings here, and I don't think there's anything to indicate that any of that was the case in this case. But I would agree with you that potentially that's a claim that could be brought to review the actions of the comptroller's discretion. I see my time is up, and I'll reserve the remainder of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Kennedy. Morning, Mr. Gillen.
Court. I think it needs to be made clear that we're not asking this court or the trial court for equitable relief at all. That is not the issue in this case. And what happened in this case is not unusual. J.D. Fields was audited for the period April 2005 through May of 2008. And an auditor discovered that they had incorrectly collected local tax on the basis of destination rather than origin. A change in the law occurred in 2007 that J.D. Fields failed to catch, and thus the error. And the auditor decided that instead of imposing tax, that they would not impose tax for the audit period, and asked the J.D. Fields correct their local tax collection methodology. And J.D. Fields said okay, and then asked for additional time to make that happen. They asked for until January 1 of 2009. This is the sort of thing that the controller does all the time, and I was happy to hear the Attorney General agree that that is something that the controller has discretion to do.
And given the timeline, are we talking about 6 months of tax, or are we talking about a month and a half of tax?
6 months of tax, Your Honor.
Okay. So the tax that would have occurred before you guys were even informed through the audit is at issue as well? How's that?
Yeah, I mean, that is true. It did happen after the audit period was over, and we were asking for a grace period in order to start collecting and do it in a way. I mean, we had to, that J.D. Fields had to change their payment systems, and they also had to retrain employees to do it the correct way. And so that was the reason for the request for additional time. And we're alleging that the auditor agreed to that. Now, that is a fact issue, and that will be a fact issue at trial. All we're asking is for a day in court. If we fail to persuade the trier of fact that the controller did in fact agree to that, we lose.
Do you agree with Mr. Kennedy that this detrimental reliance rule 3.10 is discretionary on the comptroller's part?
No, I don't agree with that at all. In fact, the controller itself doesn't agree with that. I'll just read to you a couple of decisions, one from 1990, one from 2012, that are pertinent to that. In 1990, the controller said, the controller will stand behind taxability advice given by one of its employees to the taxpayer if the information or advice is satisfactorily proven and that the taxpayer followed it and the taxpayer gives sufficient information to get through the advice. And that the taxpayer suffered harm. So they say right there that it's not discretionary. They're going to live, my word is my bond. If I told you that, I'm going to live up to it. This happened under Bullock, and that was the purpose of the rule, which incidentally was adopted pursuant to the controller's broad authority under Section 111.002 of the statute. You can read that in the preamble to the adopted rule, not under the discretion to waive penalty and interest. And then in 2012, the controller said this: the controller has a longstanding policy. If the controller's office, by certain communication or conduct directed to a given taxpayer, has induced that taxpayer to act in a particular manner, the controller should not later adopt a contrary position or course of conduct that will cause the taxpayer loss, harm, or detriment as a result of its reliance on the earlier controller action. Those are the words of the controller in 2012. So the rule, which has been in the rules since 1999 in Section 3.10, has been interpreted by the controller to be mandatory. If we tell you something, we're going to live up to it. That's the rule. It has the force and effect of law. It's a duly promulgated rule pursuant to their authority.
What about the argument that you have received relief? Because the relief doesn't entitle you to a refund, but it can be other forms of relief that the comptroller says that they've granted here.
That is the language of the rule, and the way it has been interpreted is that if we tell you, for instance, in this case, that you don't have to begin collecting tax until, you know, January 1 of 2009, then we're going to live up to that. It's much the same as what happened, if you probably remember, when the state agreed to allow Amazon to not pay tax in arrears, but to begin collecting tax. The controller lived up to that agreement. At this point in time, when this case was operable, those agreements did not have to be in writing. As of 2013, if you wanted to want to rely on advice, it has to be in writing. But during this period, it did not. So that's the sole issue in this case. Did they agree? And we acknowledge that we have to prove that at trial. But as to jurisdiction, this is kind of tax law 101. We have complied with the jurisdictional requirements in the statute for filing a protest suit. And those requirements are set out in Chapter 112, 051 through 060 of the tax code. And they are jurisdictional. This court has held that they were jurisdictional since the 70s in a case called Contran. And those requirements include you have to pay the tax under protest, and you have to accompany the payment with a written protest. You have to file suit within 90 days, and you have to attach the letter, the protest letter, to your petition. Those are jurisdictional requirements. It also has an additional jurisdictional requirement of you have to claim that the taxes were collected unlawfully, and that's what we are asserting. The controller agreed that we didn't have to begin collecting the proper local tax until January 1 of 2009, and we are asserting our right to that, to them complying with their rule that they will live up to that advice. And I don't think it's really in contention here, but this court in Texas Citrus Exchange versus Sharp in 1997 did say that the controller had to, that the rules of the controller that are duly promulgated are the law, and they have the same force and effect of legislation. And that's all we're asking for, is for the court to rule, if we prove that they agreed to allow us to collect local tax in the future, that the court uphold the rule, which has the force and effect of a statute, which requires them to live up to their word, to live up to their agreements.
Do you recall what the case was last year where Justice Blacklock got pretty bent out of shape about a state agency that had given advice to somebody, and then when they took it, it went south? He wrote a concurrence. It was very inflamed, and I was trying to remember what the issue was there.
I do not remember that case, Ryan. But that is fundamentally what's going on in this case. And you know, as I said, we acknowledge that we have the burden of proving that the advice was given. I don't agree with the state's characterization that this is just some willful sort of act on part of J.D. Fields. I mean, granted, it's not in writing. The advice was not in writing. But J.D. Fields began collecting the correct local tax in January 1 of 2009 during the subsequent audit period and made no errors once it implemented the procedures to do it correctly. So their own actions are also evidence, circumstantial evidence of their understanding that was what the controller had agreed to. But that's a fact issue, and we have to prove it. All we're asking for is our day in court. We believe that we complied with the protest statute requirements of how to get into court and sue the controller if you disagree with or you believe that they are unlawfully imposing the tax. And we've alleged a claim that they've unlawfully imposed a tax. Just because the fact that the taxes would be owed were it not for that agreement doesn't mean that we're conceding that the taxes are owed or that we're somehow subverting the law and subverting the Constitution. We're simply saying there's another statute, and that statute is if we tell you something and you rely on it and you didn't mislead us to get that information, then we're going to live up to our word. That's a statute, that's a rule that the controller has had for almost 40 years.
That's not executive grace?
Well, it's based upon in notions of equity. There's no question about that. But the rule itself is not a rule that says we can exercise this discretion. It's a rule that says if we did that, we're going to live up to our word. That's what we believe the rule says. That's how the controller has interpreted the rule for years. And we believe that rule has the force and effect of legislation, and that's the foundation of our lawsuit. I don't believe that a taxpayer can go to court and ask the court to force the agency to exercise discretion, nor are we contending that. That's what happened in a case that the state decided called S&H Marketing. In that case, which is very different from this case, the taxpayer said that a controller employee told them that they had to go get assignments in order to file a refund claim. And they alleged that somehow that caused them to blow the statute of limitations. There was no allegation that the state had waived the statute of limitations, even though they could have done so. There are specific statutes that allow the controller to waive the statute of limitations. It's something they do all of the time in audit situations. They have to do it in writing, but that's not what that case is about. Taxpayers are saying, well, you told me this, and when I went and did that, I blew the statute of limitations, and now you won't waive the statute of limitations for me. And they went to court trying to get the court to force the controller to waive the statute of limitations. That's not what this case is about at all. We're not asking the courts to order the controller to exercise discretion. We're simply asking the courts to order the controller to follow its own rule, the way the controller has interpreted that rule for years, and a rule that has the force and effect of legislation. And if you don't have further questions, I'll yield back my time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Rebuttal, Mr. Kennedy.
And Mr. Kennedy, I think that the case that Chief Justice Rose was referring to had to do with exhaustion of administrative remedies. Are you familiar with that case in which one of the agencies had basically given wrong advice as to administrative exhaustions, had told the claimant, the petitioner, you know, you can go ahead and go to court now? And I believe they followed that advice, went to court, did not exhaust their administrative remedies, and then the agency came back and the Attorney General argued, we cannot, the law is the law, you have to follow, and regardless what the agency gave advice, you didn't follow the law. That's a jurisdictional issue, and I believe that the Supreme Court came back and said, no, you cannot mislead somebody on exhaustions of administrative, exhaustions of your administrative process. Are you familiar with that case?
I am not. I'm vaguely familiar with the case, not enough to speak intelligently about it. But
that's why I was vague and not intelligent about it, too. So.
Well, I'm not sure that I was intelligent, but that's the case I think you were addressing.
And based on your description and my vague recollection of the case, I would say that case is a little bit different in that the issue, I believe, and I may be speaking out of turn here, but I believe that misleading somebody on the jurisdictional prerequisites may present a due process issue. In other words, if you're telling them you can get into court now and that's not actually correct, there may be different interests at issue than in this case. In this case, they followed all of the jurisdictional prerequisites in the case, as my colleague said when he was up here. Now, those are the procedures you have to follow to get into court. But the scope of immunity is also defined by the statute. So here, we're not really addressing whether or not the prerequisites were followed. They were. But you can't just bring a tax protest suit and say, some other state agency ran over my dog, therefore give me a refund of my taxes. That's not within the scope of a tax suit. The tax suit has to be, a tax protest suit has to be, the taxes are unlawful. Usually that means challenge a constitutional challenge to the statute. Or second, that the comptroller can't lawfully collect the taxes. Usually in a typical case, that's, well, we're entitled to this exemption and the comptroller's misinterpreting it, or the comptroller's misinterpreting the taxing statute. Neither of those are what are the case here. Here we have a situation where the J.D. Fields is trying to hold the comptroller liable and stop them from enforcing the tax code. So we've got a completely different situation than what the scope of the waiver of sovereign immunity is here. And as my colleague alluded to, in S&H Marketing versus Sharp, the comptroller is not, this court said the comptroller is not liable and cannot be stopped even by the erroneous acts of its agents or employees. And that was a case where the comptroller gave erroneous advice, and is more like the case that you were describing, where their advice led to a situation where they couldn't even have their day in court procedurally because they had blown the jurisdictional prerequisites. So those cases are about sort of the procedure to get into court, whereas this case is about what the scope of the immunity actually is. And that scope is limited. It's not a waiver of sovereign immunity for any suit that you could possibly bring to get the comptroller to give you a refund of taxes.
We're just FYI, we're going to give you a couple extra minutes since we had a really long question there at the beginning of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. So back to what I was saying about sovereign immunity, because I don't think I fully addressed that during my opening argument. A comptroller rule just can't make taxes that are correctly assessed under a statute unlawful. That would be going back to the constitutional arguments. That presents a conflict between the two. And if there's a conflict between these two, between a rule and a statute, the statute prevails. That's the way it's always been.
You guys seem to have a disagreement over what the nature of the detriment or reliance discretion the comptroller has, as to whether it's purely discretionary or whether they're bound by it once they enter into something. I mean, is it executive grace that can't be enforced by a court? I mean, what authority do you have to kind of give us the kind of definitive word on what the nature of that is?
Well, so the detrimental reliance, the way that the comptroller can do that, the only way they can do that is through their discretionary powers. There's no statute that says that they can explicitly forgive taxes. The legislature has an interest in having the comptroller enforce the laws that they promulgate, now that they pass. When the legislature passes a law, they have an expectation that the executive is going to enforce it absent some discretionary activity. So, I know my colleagues cited to comptroller decisions where they said, you know, we'll take this advice. That's all discretionary. Those are comptroller decisions. The comptroller made that decision voluntarily within its discretion to abide by its word. And it does that regularly. But there are also regularly times where the comptroller says, you haven't proven that you detrimentally relied on this. There are other comptroller decisions where there was a situation where the comptroller gave correct advice and then later gave incorrect advice. The comptroller has always said in that instance, when there's correct advice and incorrect advice like there is here, detrimental reliance doesn't apply. That's been their interpretation of the rule all along. Unless there are any questions, my time's been up for a while, so I will ask the court to reverse and render a judgment.
All right. Well, thank you both for a well-argued case. The case will be submitted and the court will stand in recess.